to sing a river. We, la session in English or in French?
English is better.
Yeah. So the session is taped because it goes, we put it on the web. Okay. So you need to sign a waiver saying that you actually agree to be taped.
Okay. Okay. Now let me get signatures.
Natalie hasn't signed.
Okay. So, Natalie.
Yes.
Just to sign here, it's a waiver if we, because we put it up on our website. Okay. Perfecto. Let's see.
Is Jessica talking first?
So you go first.
I go first. Okay. So,
okay,
they modified it. So this one.
Good. Welcome.
Hi. I forgot.
Okay, that's where. Oh, okay.
There you go. There's a pointer right here. Do you prefer a lapel mic or this one?
Probably a lapel mic.
A lapel? So okay. This chin.
Anybody else with sound?
Picture lady. Okay. So, good evening. I am sorry to take you away from the beautiful spring weather to be inside our wonderful auditorium. This is the fourth and last public forum, Goodman Public Forum, on fighting cancer with knowledge and hope, le savoir et l'espoir dans la lutte contre le cancer. Welcome to those of you that it may be the first time attending these lectures. We're always pleased that you show up and you participate in this. So this evening, we will do things almost in the same way we normally do. For those of you that have not attended this before, my name is Nicole Beauchemin. I am a professor here in the Faculty of Medicine, and I'm a member of the Goodman Cancer Research Center. I'm also a professor in medicine, biochemistry, and oncology. And so, four bosses. So I will be the moderator tonight, which means I'll be introducing our speakers, and I will also moderate the question period. So you have received in your registration some cue cards, and I'm not sure if they still give out little pencils. If you have questions that come up during the presentation, please write them down. There'll be volunteers coming down the aisles later to pick them up, and at the end of the presentations, we'll have our panel up in the front to answer your questions. So one of the things we're doing reversed here is it's always a bit of a rush at the end, and I think it's very important to acknowledge those people that make this event possible. And the first group of people is, of course, the Goodman family, who've been supporting this public forum for many, many years. And so we'd like to publicly acknowledge their gift, and we would like to thank them very much. I am told that we're doing this again next year. So we will have the possibility. The second group of people are some of those that you probably met outside, are the students and the personnel from the Goodman Cancer Research Center who act as volunteer, help us set up the event, and are always there to help us when we need them. So thank you very much, and we truly appreciate that you participate in this. And last, but certainly not the least, and she's trying to hide behind her iPhone back there, Mrs. Annette Novak, who is the spirit and the organizer of these sessions. And without her, it would be really difficult. So thank you so very much. You also have received survey sheets. We will be planning in early June or mid-June, the next series for next year. So please make sure to tell us if you have topics that you'd like to hear about, particular cancers that you're wondering what the new discoveries are, how they're treated. We will do our best to answer these queries and to get together a program that, again, will bring you down to McGill to listen to our fabulous speakers from all over the city. So please fill out the survey. It is really, really helpful. And we have to say that most of the topics we presented this year were actually recommended by the public. And as you can see, they were quite well attended. And then my last sort of piece of business, we've been asked by the Cole Foundation, Mr. Barry Cole is here sitting in the audience, to introduce a day of research celebration day, which will be held on May 13th. It's going to be held right here in this same auditorium. The Cole Foundation has organized this day to promote research in leukemia and immune diseases, and we'll have a guest speaker whose name is Stephen Hunger, and he's the chief of the Division of Oncology and the director for the Center for Childhood Cancer Research at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. And he's an expert in precision medicine therapies and pediatric acute lymphoblastic leukemia. So for children who have this disease, he's a world-known expert. So if you want to know more, you're certainly invited to attend, and you most likely can get this information on the website for the Cole Foundation. Am I right? Yes, I'm right. So tonight's presentations are on the journey Childhood versus Adult Cancer on Leukemia. We have seen some really fantastic developments in how children are actually being treated. And to the wonderful possibility that now these children grow up to adulthood and live fruitful lives. But there are certainly consequences to this, and there's various forms. There's childhood leukemia, and there is adult cancers of leukemia. So our first speaker tonight will be Dr. Natalie Johnson. Dr. Johnson is an assistant professor in the Division of Medicine, Hematology, and Oncology at McGill University. She's been at the Jewish General Hospital since 2010. She completed her medical studies at the University of Ottawa in internal medicine and oncology training at McGill University. She then left and went all the way to the British Columbia Cancer Agency to do a clinical fellowship in molecular pathology. Then she needed more, and she went on to do a PhD in pathology and laboratory medicine at the University of British Columbia. She has then came back to the Jewish in 2010. She's been awarded a scholarship from the Fonds de Recherche en Santé du Québec. She's also a Canada Research Chair in Hematology and Oncology, and her research focuses on studying biological properties of cancer cells that render them more resistant to chemotherapy. Dr. Johnson.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me to speak tonight. Where do I?
There's a pointer.
I need a clicker.
I don't have a...
So
anywhere.
I have to stay here then.
Yes. Okay. In any case, you have to stay here because you're being taped.
Yes.
So if you walk all over, we'll miss you.
We'll miss me. Okay. So I'm a clinician scientist. I'm a hematologist in the adolescent and young adult clinic at the Jewish General Hospital. I treat patients with a lymphoma and with a particular focus on the adolescent and young adult population. So today that's what I'm going to share my experience with you about that. And you're going to learn about lymphoma. Not so much about leukemia, mostly lymphomas. In this patient population, you're going to learn about their treatment at diagnosis, at relapse, and issues relating to survivorship. So my family and I are volunteers for the Ironman. And sometimes I watch these people do the Ironman, and it is phenomenal. It is grueling, and sometimes I see my patients go through some of this agony through their treatment, and I think that surviving lymphoma is like doing an Ironman. And my role is to coach them and to tell them to focus when they need to focus. But we need a team, and we have a team, and I'll tell you about that team. So some of the challenges in this patient population in particular are unique, and we don't see them as much in older adults. In particular, the psychosocial factors of being diagnosed with a cancer in this age group. It impacts important social milestones. These young patients are often in university, so they have to stop their studies, take a leave of absence, and they find themselves disconnected from their social network. They're starting their career, which they have to halt as well. There's a loss of financial independence. for students who have part-time jobs can no longer do that, so some of them have to return at home to live, so which is a big issue, loss of independence. Relationships are important. They're married, have boyfriends, girlfriends, so intimacy is an issue. Some of them have young children they have to take care of. You know, I was told, oh, I can't come before this time because my daughter has to go to daycare. Or there's important issues about delaying starting a family. They're about to start, they want to get pregnant, and then they're told, no, you can't get pregnant for another 2 years. And social isolation. So all of these are really critical. And it makes it that they don't see their own mortality as being as important as the other issues in their life. And often I have to find myself negotiating with them to start therapy earlier because they will find ways to delay, try to say, well, I can't do this now because of this other thing. The cancers in the young patients also are biologically a little bit different. Just like the young patients are fast and furious, well, their lymphomas are also fast and furious. They have genetic abnormalities that make them grow faster. But I'm not going to talk to you about that today. And the young patients are underrepresented in clinical trials. We don't know them that well. In particular, the 14 to 17-year-olds, they have some lymphomas that are more adult, and so they don't are not there are not that many lymphoma trials available for them, and they are too young to participate in the adult trials. Right. There's delays in diagnosis. For some reason, people think that young patients don't get cancer, so they often present to the eMERGE several times before a diagnosis is made. And so there are some issues with compliance as well. So when I talked about a team, the team that I'm referring to is the McGill Adolescent and Young Adult Oncology Program. It's a multidisciplinary team that is led by Dr. Kavan, and it includes a host of different doctors that I include here, and I'm the hematologist in the group. But there are also very important non-MD partners. In particular, the nurses, a dietitian, rehab, all my kids that have lymphoma, I encourage them to exercise throughout their therapy. There's a psychologist, a social worker, Hope and Cope, and we have Doreen Edwards, who is in charge of VOBOC, the VOBOC Foundation, and they are wonderful to really provide support for the AYA POSH population. They gave them free backpacks and a lot of different things. So lymphoma is actually the most common cancer in this age group, which it, for to be considered a young adult is to be less than 40. So 15 to 39 is considered young. The most common lymphomas in this age group are Hodgkin's disease and diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And they're both curable with chemotherapy. So what is lymphoma? Well, lymphoma is a cancer of the lymphocytes. They present with enlarged nodes that we find in the neck or under the armpits, in the groin. But you can have it in the chest and the abdomen. And they, some of the patients can have what we call B symptoms, which means they have fevers, sweats, and weight loss. So they feel sick. They feel tired, unwell. Not all of them, but some of them do. So I'm often asked, why did I get lymphoma? Is it hereditary? And I tell them, well, it's not hereditary, but it is genetic. So your immune system is designed to create antibodies to fight infections. That's why we have an immune system. So every time we're exposed to new bacteria or viruses, your immune cells, your lymphocytes, are exposed to them and then travel to the germinal center of the lymph node, and try to make the perfect antibody for that new virus. But in so doing, it has to break its DNA, rearrange the DNA in the immunoglobulin gene, which is the antibody gene. And so it breaks the DNA, remakes all these different antibodies, and sometimes a mistake can happen. And that's most commonly we have lymphomas, the DLBC, the diffuse large B, and the Hodgkin's. That's what happens, is a genetic mistake occurs so that cell no longer can die, and it evades being seen by the immune system, so which we'll go over as well. So that's what happens. And so in order to cure this, we treat them with chemotherapy. So what do we use for chemotherapy? Well, in fact, chemotherapy was designed after World War II when they found that soldiers coming back from war that were exposed to mustard gas had decreased white blood cell counts. And so they thought, well, for diseases that have high white blood cell counts, like leukemias and lymphomas, maybe that would be helpful. And so the first chemotherapy with the mustard gas they made a derivation of that called mustardgin. And that formed was part of the first kind of cocktail that we used to treat Hodgkin's lymphoma. There was no rhyme or reason why these drugs were put together other than they worked individually and they didn't have too much in terms of overlapping toxicity. So the first chemotherapy for Hodgkin's, which was curative in a subset of patients, was called MOP. And my older colleagues at the Jewish still remember how much nausea it made the patients feel tremendously sick. They would have a bucket next to their chemotherapy chair and they would just throw up all the time. But two other important side effects that made us change MOP to another chemotherapy is the sterility that it induced in our patients and the secondary leukemias. So in 1975, we changed to ABVD, which is four different drugs, which is much better tolerated. But it's still hard. I mean, most patients get several cycles. And it has its own toxicities, although the toxicities of ABVD are a lot less. And we knew that when these two large clinical trials showed that ABVD and MOP were equivalent in terms of efficacy. But because ABVD doesn't cause sterility and secondary leukemias, we advocated for ABVD. We used ABVD. And for a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 1976, was when we used CHOP, which is similar concept. You're killing rapidly dividing cells with different drugs that target different aspects of the cell cycle. And they also have secondary or side effects. So what has happened since then? This is crazy. We're still using drugs that we put together in the 70s. What has happened since then? Well, what has happened, more or less, which I'm going to talk about today, is we compared these drug regimens with more aggressive drug regimens, and we found that these were just more toxic and not more effective. So we stayed with the least toxic. And what we're learning is that there are better, smarter ways to kill cancer cells, and that's using knowledge on the lymphoma biology, which we'll learn about today. And the other exciting thing is that we could harness the power of the immune system. Some of the general principles when you are a doctor is first do no harm. And I think, being a clinician scientist, I think that without research, there's no hope for improvement. But this is, you have to try these different regimens, and there are toxicities. Some of the worst things have been done to patients with the best intentions. And for those who are interested in learning about this history of cancer, I highly recommend the book, The Emperor of All Maladies, which really, I think, explains that well. So for advanced Hodgkin's lymphoma, I told you that ABVD is the standard. What you're looking at here is a survival curve where the survival is plotted over time, and you see that it's that they're essentially almost identical. The ABVD and the Biocop, which is the more aggressive regimen, yields a very similar survival at 7 years, and it's excellent. So it's over 85% for advanced age Hodgkin's, and so what we need to focus on is to minimize the toxicity for the survivors. For lymphoma, I told you that CHOP was the standard. This was compared to three other regimens that were more aggressive, and it was the same in terms of overall survival, around 40%, until we discovered an antibody called rituximab that binds to a protein on the surface of lymphoma cells. And this was really revolutionized the treatment for CD20-positive lymphomas. And what happens is that it essentially acts as a flag for your immune system. It binds to the lymphoma and says, kill me, kill me. It activates the complement-mediated cytotoxicity and cell-mediated cytotoxicity. And this has improved the survival by 50%, okay? So whereas before it was 40%, now the survival for R-CHOP-treated patients is around 60-65%, and it's even higher in young patients because they have rapidly growing tumors. They are more susceptible to these tumors are more susceptible to being killed by chemotherapy. All right, so what are the immediate toxicities of chemotherapy that our adolescent and young adults need to deal with? Well, the two most life-threatening complications are bleomycin lung toxicity, which is rare, but it can be fatal. So I always ask my patients if they're short of breath or if they're coughing, and neutropenic infection, meaning that when you give chemotherapy, it not only affects the lymphocytes as immune cells, but other immune cells called neutrophils. And if you're neutropenic, you can have severe life-threatening infections. So those are the two most common things that I worry about. Of course, my patients don't really worry about that much. They worry more about the hair loss, because that means that people see me and they see the people see them as having cancer. Now the reality sets in. But that will grow back. They are more tired, so they can't perform as well. Like if they decide to continue to work, they have nausea and sometimes loss of appetite, which is exacerbated by anxiety. Oddly enough, there could be weight gain because of the steroids that they use, and they can have pimples because of the steroids. So that's again not dangerous complications, but they still have to deal with those issues. The skin, mucous membranes, everything can be affected by chemotherapy, which makes them unable to work and be depressed and anxious. So what happens after chemotherapy? So they've completed their ABVD and R-CHOP. The first thing that we want to know is there a response? And most often than not, we do a PET scan. It's the most sensitive way to assess remission in lymphoma. And there are four different possibilities. There could be progression, which is very rare, but happens in 5% of patients. Stable disease means that there's less than 50% of lymph node reduction mass. And there's still a lot of disease there. Partial remission means that the nodes have shrunk by more than 50%, but there's still residual lymphoma. And complete remission, it's all gone. Okay, so if their lymphoma is not all gone, what we really want to document is to see is this lymphoma that's there, because it could be a false positive. And so what I always recommend is to biopsy. And if it is positive, then there is salvage chemotherapy to demonstrate that the lymphoma is still sensitive to chemotherapy, and then there's an autologous stem cell transplant where you give such high doses of chemotherapy that the that it would kill off the normal stem cells of the marrow, but you're giving back the marrow that you've collected, and so that's the standard approach at the time of relapse. Of course, if they're in partial remission and there's just a little bit that's left on the PET scan and it's within a radiation field, then the patients get radiation therapy because lymphoma is very sensitive to radiation. But because of the long-term toxicities of radiation, we don't use it only when we need to. And a complete response means that there's no further therapy and there's no further scans. So this means that we still stay in contact with patient because we want to make sure that they that there's no relapses. We see them every 3 months and every 6 months for 3 years. Every 3 months for 2 years and then every 6 months for 3 years and then every year. And, of course, I don't want them to get pregnant during the first 2 years. If there's a relapse, it can complicate things. And the goal is for them to return to normal. And long-term toxicities. These are survival curves of Hodgkin survivors and children for long, long, 25 years later, and we see that their survival is not the same as an average adult. And this is at the time when we were using a lot of radiation, and ultimately what we find is that there's a lot of secondary cancers, up to 22%, 1% a year. So which is why we don't try not to use radiation. But there's could be secondary leukemias. I told you that it's is much less with ABVD, still 1%, but still we have to monitor that. So there's a risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, breast cancer in patients that had radiation to the chest. And so we essentially advocate really healthy lifestyle habits. There's other complications, hormonal issues, cardiac issues that can also occur from chemotherapy, which we need to monitor. And overall, the risk of infertility with the chemotherapy is low, very low, less than 5%. Mostly people who have problems initially, then they have difficulties getting pregnant later on. And so I told you when chemotherapy fails, we give a non-autologous stem cell transplant. This is a month in hospital. It's a big deal. But it is very effective. It cures. Even if you have relapse lymphoma, it cures 50% of patients with Hodgkin's and 30% of patients with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So what happens if that doesn't work? Well, for Hodgkin's lymphoma, we have new immune therapies. One is brentuximab. It's an antibody that's linked to chemotherapy, so the antibody binds to the tumor cell, and it's internalized, and it kills the cancer cell that way. So it's a smarter way of delivering chemotherapy. And in patients who failed everything have responded. This is a waterfall plot, and it's essentially looking at the every line downwards means that there's a response. It's a decrease in node size. And 94% respond. It's really well tolerated, except for neuropathy, and it's expensive. There's a newer antibody that works in a completely different way. So our immune system is designed to have breaks. So when you get sick, your immune system is activated to fight the infection, but it also has to stop, or else it destroys the host. It's too much inflammation. This break is used by cancer to evade being seed. And one of the proteins that they use is this PD-1. And there's a new drug that binds to PD-1 and allows the cancer to be seen again by the immune system. And this is very, very remarkable, extremely cool. I have 10 patients on trial with this drug, and it is the force. The force awakens. It happens fast. I never thought the immune system could be so powerful. And in our patients, all 9 out of the 10 patients responded to the drug. But the force, there's always a dark side to the force. One of the side effects is that it can harm the body. the host having autoimmune side effects. And so I've had a patient whose heart stopped, literally, went into cardiac arrest from this, and another went into what we call tamponade. So it means that there's this liquid that surrounds the heart that the heart no longer can pump properly. So extremely powerful force that works completely different than chemotherapy. No pregnancies allowed, though, for young patients. This is important. And why is that? Is that pregnant women use PD-1 to tolerate the fetus. This is a natural occurring thing. This is why pregnant women don't, they stay pregnant. And so if you're on a PD-1 inhibitor, then you can't get pregnant because this means that your body will be able to look at the fetus as foreign and you will kill the fetus. So it's a very challenging, challenging scenario. So in summary, I think that we are doing very well in terms of curing cancers and in curing lymphomas in adolescent and young adults. I think they're curable in over 80% of patients. There are toxicities that we need to deal with the chemotherapy and with the novel therapies. And right now we also have to deal with survivorship issues, their medical issues and psychosocial issues. So I have a dual personality. I have my doctor side, but I have my research side, which is supported by all those wonderful foundations, including the Cole Foundation. But what I want to say also is that I'm very grateful to my patients and their families. They keep me humble, and one of them will speak today, and I'm grateful to her. I'll welcome your questions. Thanks for your attention.
So thank you so much, Natalie. Our second speaker tonight is a cancer researcher here at the Goodman Cancer Research Center. He's now an associate professor in the Department of Physiology in the GCRC. He obtained his PhD in Toronto in the Department of Medical Biophysics, where he was working under the supervision of Dr. Pam Owashi, specializing in immunology with an emphasis on what are called T lymphocyte signal transduction pathway. He'll explain it. He has a very nice graphic to do this. I've seen this before. So after he finished in Toronto, he went down to the University of Pennsylvania, where he did some postdoctoral studies with Dr. Craig Thompson, where he actually was conducting seminal work there on a protein that's called AMP, dependent protein kinase, for short, AMPK. You can't go to a talk these days without hearing about AMPK. So you will become AMPK experts tonight. And then he accepted our offer to join us here, and with his background in immunology, cancer biology, he's helped to create a new research unit within the Goodman Cancer Research Center on oncometabolism. So this also deals with metabolisms and how cells are fed and get their nutrients to survive. So it's my pleasure to welcome my colleague, Rusty Jones.
Good. Thank you, Nicole. Bienvenue à tous. Nice to see everyone. Very welcome to this great night. I always really enjoy coming to the public forum because it forces me to really sort of think about what we do every day and to speak to everyone in a common language, because as you heard from Nicole, between oncometabolism and AMPK, I might as well be speaking another language. So let's all, goal here is tonight to bring the language together so we can, you can understand a little bit of what we do here at the Goodman, in particular, my research. So, as Nicole mentioned, our interest is in this field called oncometabolism, and I think it's important to put into context of what I do as a scientist. So I'm a basic scientist. I'm not a clinician, so I'm not trained as a medical doctor. But I think it's important to understand sort of the continuum of where we're all in the sort of the field of cancer research. So my job really is to understand the basic biology of cancer cells. So again, what differentiates a normal cell from a cancer cell, how the circuitry is different. And so if you want to think of it, you could view me as a mechanic. I'm sure my dad would have wondered why I went to school for so long to be a mechanic. But I'm a biological mechanic, because the challenge with cancer is a cell is like a car. And it's wired a certain way. It has an engine to fuel itself. There are different inputs, gas pedal, brakes, to make it go forward. But we have to understand, my job as a basic scientist is really to try to understand what makes up the car, what are the parts, what makes it go. And so a cancer cell and different cancer cells are all like different cars that we don't know how they work. And so my job as a basic scientist is really to discover the map of how the car is built, how it runs. And then by understanding that at a more basic level, we can figure out ways to stop the car from moving if the case of a cancer cell. It's sort of an analogy in that regard. I like to say this because what I study in particular is understanding what pushes the cancer cell forward and what stops the cancer cell in terms of fuel. And so what I'm going to talk to you today about is this field of oncometabolism, and it's really trying to understand how a cancer cell fuels itself, ultimately with the goal to find new ways of treating cancer. So we just to put everyone in the frame of reference, so cancer, it's a disease of deregulated growth and proliferation, and so we can think of a single tumor cell existing, and then as a tumor is growing, or cancer is growing, it's because the cells in this tumor are actually dividing. And so when we think of, for example, a solid tumor is in a mass of cancer cells that are proliferating rapidly because of mutations that help to drive this growth. And so we've been thinking about cancer biology at a very, very basic level, because if you're trying to build a cell and duplicate a cell, you need certain basic things. You need energy, and you need raw materials or nutrients to build. So if you think about it, if you're actually going to go, for example, build an addition onto your house, okay, you need to get the bricks, you need to get the mortar, you need to have a good breakfast so that you can actually do it yourself. And these are all the same types of principles that go into a cell that's dividing. In order to build a second cell, you need energy and you need raw materials. So this is what makes a tumor cell very unique, is because they actually change the way they generate energy and how they acquire raw materials. And this is what we call metabolism. It's the organization, the generation of energy and repurposing that energy to build things. And so there's a couple fundamental things that we think about fueling. A tumor cell is really not that different from other cells of the body, but cancer cells have particular needs, and they go about fueling these needs in specific ways. And in particular, cancer cells, in general, increase their nutrient uptake. And so what I mean by that is that, this is an example, this is a B-cell lymphoma line, very similar to what Dr. Johnson just introduced. And what we can see in these B-cell lymphomas is on the surface of these cancer cells, they have what we call nutrient transporters. These are proteins that are on the surface of the cell, which will actually serve as channels to bring in more nutrients into the cell. So what we're actually looking at here are nutrient transporters for amino acids. So amino acids are the building blocks that help to build proteins. So if you're a rapidly dividing cell and you need to build more proteins, you need the raw materials. And so tumor cells actually will increase the expression of nutrient transporters on the surface so they can get more in order to fulfill this need. And there's another very unique characteristic of tumor cells, is that they become dependent on certain nutrients. And a very good example of this is glucose or sugar. And so if we consider a normal cell, which will use glucose as a fuel source in order to make energy, cancer cells are not that different from a normal cell because they also use glucose to make energy. They just take up a lot more and they use a lot more in order to generate the energy they need to grow and proliferate. And so Dr. Johnson just introduced a very interesting idea about PET scanning. So this is an imaging technique which is used in the clinic every day to visualize tumors, particularly lymphomas. And so this has its roots in the study of metabolism and fuel, because what PET imaging or PET scanning is doing, it's a full-body imaging technique that actually takes advantage of the unique properties of a cancer cell using glucose. So PET scanning, in the case of PET scanning, what you do is you give a patient a labeled chemical called FDG, or 18-fluoro-2-deoxyglucose. And all that is a radioactive form of sugar. Okay, so you give this to a patient. It's not a radioactive dose that's going to actually harm the patient, but it can be differentiated from other sugar in the body because it will emit a radioactive signal, which can be picked up on the PET scan. So FDG actually looks just like glucose. It's taken up by cells the same way as glucose. And so you can actually visualize tissues in the body that take up glucose using this technique. And so, of course, normal cells will take this up. So, your heart uses a lot of glucose because your heart is constantly pumping. It needs a lot of energy, and it uses glucose to derive this. But tumor cells also do this. And so if you actually look at this example of this PET scan here, what you'll notice is the heart, the brain, two tissues that take up a lot of glucose, and they're visualized by this PET scan. And you can also see this cancer that is metastasized to the lymph node. And I'll just start this little video, and you can actually see it in 3D space. So PET scanning is taking advantage of the fact that tumor cells actually take up sugar at a higher rate than normal tissues. And so it has many uses in cancer. We heard that it can be used to detect cancer. It can be used to stage cancer, so predict which stages you're in, and also to study responses to therapy. And so if you actually think about it, it's quite amazing because almost 70% of all tumors can actually be visualized strictly by the basis that they take up sugar at a greater rate than other cells. Okay. So you can also use this metabolic principle to look at how tumors respond to therapy. And so this is an example of a PET scan of a patient that here now has tumors in the liver. You can actually see them here as denoted by the T. And so these big sort of hot spots on the PET scan are two sites where you have tumors that are growing in the liver. Then post-therapy, so this would be a chemotherapy or a targeted therapy, you can actually see that now these tumors, they're not gone, okay, because you've just had therapy, but the tumors are dying, and as a consequence, they're not taking up sugar at the same rate. So you can actually predict responses to therapy by the metabolic changes within the cancer. And so one of the big questions is why do tumor cells become addicted to sugar? Because normal cells do take up sugar. They usually process sugar in order to make energy. Cancer cells use glucose or sugar in a little bit of a different way. So this fellow here is named Otto Warburg, very famous Nobel Prize-winning biochemist from Germany who discovered in the late 20s this principle known as the Warburg effect, which really just characterizes what I just described to you, the fact that tumor cells take up a lot of sugar. And he had a really interesting observation that when tumor cells take up sugar, again, glucose comes through into the cell through one of these nutrient transporters that I showed you earlier, and then it gets processed through a biochemical pathway called glycolysis. And all the glycolysis is a process in which glucose is broken down into a smaller molecule known as pyruvate. This is akin to taking oil as a raw material, so bitumen is your glucose, and then processing it through this pathway in order to get high-octane fuel that you can use to run your car. Okay? So normal cells will take this pyruvate, load it into the mitochondria, which is an organelle inside cells, which is like an engine. And so pyruvate is a fuel source that is burned in the mitochondria in order to generate energy. Now, normal cells will actually take about 95% of the pyruvate that's made from glucose and use it to make energy. It's like loading the engine with fuel in order to generate energy. Very little of it is wasted, so less than 5 to 10%. But tumor cells are completely the opposite. Okay? Although I should say the majority of tumor cells are completely the opposite. So instead of taking this pyruvate and loading it into the mitochondria to make energy this way, they use a different methodology involving glycolysis to make energy this way. So they really switch their type of metabolism. They're highly dependent on sugar, and they're using it in a very different way. And so what's interesting is that we know cancer is a genetic disease, and so there are different oncogenes, so cancer-causing genes that will help to drive tumors like lymphoma. Or there are tumor suppressors, which are very important genes that stop cancer growth, and when they're lost will actually cause cancer. And what's interesting is that many of the common mutations, either oncogenes or tumor suppressors, when their levels are manipulated, they actually promote this addiction to using sugar. So, as I just mentioned, we have this new sort of principle in which a tumor cell that's growing will actually use glucose or sugar in a different way. And what I'm often asked about this, well, if it's all about energy, why would a tumor cell use glucose in a different way that's maybe not as efficient? So if you go back here and actually consider the mitochondria as a very efficient way to making energy, I've just told you that your tumor cell will now not use that engine and rather will use this other methodology to make energy. And what's interesting is that what we found really over the last 5 years is it's not all about energy. But it's also about building blocks. Okay, so there's some very fundamental building blocks if you're trying to build a new cell. If you're trying to go from a single cell to double and to make two cells, you need to make DNA, so you need to replicate your DNA. You have to make fat molecules because fat molecules make up the membranes that encapsulate a cell. So if you imagine that, if you're going from one cell to two cell, you have to duplicate all of your DNA. And you have to make a whole bunch of new fats to make membranes. And on top of that, the proteins that help to be, that are scaffolds in the cell and help to run chemical reactions also have to be duplicated. So what we found is that what metabolism really is happening to cells is that you're taking sugar and then your process, tumor cells are processing the sugar to make energy, but it's also directing some of this sugar in order to make new building blocks. So essentially, you're using sugar as a base nutrient in order to make new bricks, make new mortar so that the cells can actually divide. And so what's interesting about understanding cancer metabolism in this fashion is a lot like examining the maps of a highway. How are nutrients used to make things that the cells need? And more importantly, do these pathways change in a cancer cell? And what we're finding out is that in a lot of cases, the pathways do change, right? So instead of going down the right ramp, normally, that you would need in order to make energy, you're driving in the wrong direction or using different nutrients to do this. And this is really the active area of research right now, sort of studying beyond sugar what's important for tumor cells. Okay. So as I just mentioned, tumor cells need to make energy. They need to make building blocks. And here's where I think there's a really interesting avenue or a different way of looking at therapeutic approaches for cancer, because the general concept in cancer biology right now is that we have what we call these oncogenic drivers. These would be, as I mentioned, the mutations in cancer that cause cancer and allow it to persist, make them resistant to therapy and whatnot. And what we're finding is that these oncogenic drivers will reprogram the metabolism of a tumor cell. So again, for example, an oncogene like MYC, and I'll talk about it in a second, will actually push a cancer cell to really use a lot of sugar in order to grow. And in doing so, what we're finding is that this confers what we call metabolic dependencies. Again, if you're using a lot of sugar, then you're becoming addicted to sugar and you need it in order to fuel your growth. And so what we're actually doing at the Goodman Cancer Center is really using basic science techniques to understand how this metabolic reprogramming happens. So these are actually pictures from our metabolomics facility that we have on the fourth floor of the Goodman Cancer Research Center. Basically, it's almost like a CSI approach to understanding what's going on in a cancer cell. We break open the cancer cells and we study the metabolites that are the small molecules of biochemical pathways and study how they're changed in tumor cells. And so, for example, We use these machines in order to measure the quantities of different metabolites. So, for example, here, this is what a metabolic profile of a lymphoma cell actually looks like. It has very, very low levels of glucose inside the cell, and the reason why it does is because it's converting most of this glucose into lactate, which is the end product of the glycolytic pathway that I introduced to you. So this low glucose and high lactate signature is a characteristic hallmark of the Warburg effect. This is an example. This would be a very high positive PET scan type of tumor. But you can see that there are lots of other changes that are occurring in these tumor cells. There are differences in amino acids and fats. And so we're really trying to understand what this all means for cancer biology. And we're combining this with new technologies such as computer modeling. And I'm going to put this up not to scare everyone, because this scares me too whenever I look at it. But we're trying to sort of look and use techniques such as DNA sequencing, genomics, and the field that I've just been describing, which is metabolomics, the studying of metabolism and metabolites, in order to reconstruct what the metabolism or the metabolic network of a tumor cell actually looks like. And so, for example, what I'm just showing you here is how these different metabolic pathways are actually interconnected in tumor cells. And in particular, we can find in red here specific nodes of this particular tumor cell, which is a lung cancer cell line, which make it unique from a normal cell. And again, if you have a unique metabolic pathway, such as this enzyme PCK2, which is used normally by liver cells, not cancer cells, to promote metabolism, could this be a new way of targeting these tumor cells? Okay, so I just want to end off with a little example of how we're sort of thinking about these questions. I discussed about these oncogenic drivers. Again, this is where we get into the scientific alphabet soup that I was talking about. These are oncogenes, for example, that promote cancer. These are tumor suppressors that are normally suppress cancer and are typically lost in different tumor types. We've been studying a specific oncogene known as MYC, which is very prominently mutated or its expression is increased in leukemia and lymphoma. And what we found is that, in particular, when you have a cell that is when MYC is turned on in these cells, this really promotes more glucose metabolism, right? So this Warburg effect that I introduced is very, very high because MYC, when it's on, promotes a lot of glucose usage. But in doing so, it creates a dependence. So now these tumor cells, because they're using a lot of glucose, a lot of sugar, they now become dependent on this. And so we can go back and look at use this map that I sort of threw up there very quickly to identify specific genes or pathways that help to regulate this metabolism. And one of these particular genes is a transcription factor known as HIF-1 alpha. The name of the gene doesn't matter. What is important is that we can show genetically that HIF-1 alpha is important for driving the metabolism of these tumor cells. So, for example, these are the number of tumor cells that are growing in an experimental model, an experimental animal, with a control construct which doesn't change the tumor cell. And we can see that when we put these tumor cells into an animal, they form tumors at the same frequency. But if we take these tumor cells and we knock out, we eliminate the expression of this particular gene in these lymphoma cells, now they can't form tumors in the experimental animal. So this is how we approach these types of questions from a basic science perspective. We identify interconnections, in this case, that are regulating metabolism, and then we look for the regulators. So, for example, HIF-1 alpha, in this case, can be viewed as a target or a new targeted therapy, a specific therapy, a therapeutic target, I should say, for this type of lymphoma. Now the challenge is how do you target this with a drug in which settings for cancer, which is where we then move on and work with doctors and develop what we call preclinical models and then moving towards the clinic. So this is exactly how the immune therapy checkpoints treatments, which are now in the clinic, were developed. These were originally identified as receptors on T cells, for example, that regulated their function. But it moved from a basic science question into the clinical space, leading to the breakthroughs that we see today. Okay, so I'd just like to thank the people who really do this, or the people who work in my lab. We have many past and present members who really have been fundamental to pushing our discoveries forward. And in particular, I'd like to highlight the Goodman Cancer Research Center core facility, the Metabolomics Core Facility, which is really a unique facility, certainly in Montreal and in Canada as a whole, which allows us to do these types of experiments. And much like Dr. Johnson said, we'd be nothing if we didn't have funding sources to do this. So thank you very much for your attention, and I'll be happy to take questions at the end. Cheers.
So now you'll never be able to go through the Turcotte interchange without thinking that there's a cancer growing and that they've rerouted the building blocks and that we're not sure they've got targeted therapy. Okay, so our third speaker tonight is an invited guest from across the mountain. We go back for some years.
Yep.
So Dr. Sinet is a professor in the Department of Pediatrics and Biochemistry. He holds a research chair in pediatric oncogenomics at the University of Montreal. He also acts as the director of the Strategic Axis Viral and Immune Diseases and Cancer at St. Justin University Health Center. And he's recently been promoted and appointed director of the FRQS Applied Medical Genetics Network. So a great pleasure to welcome Daniel Sinet.
Merci, Nicole. Thank you, everyone. It's a real pleasure to be here. I mean, it's always fun to see people taking time of their own and come to here later and hear about leukemia. So thank you. So what I will try to do tonight is two things. Talk about childhood leukemia. So between 0 and 14, you hear a bit more about these young adults and adolescents. And tell you about, talk about two stories to describe you, where are the major issues in terms of research with that particular population of cancer patients. And hopefully we'll be able to do this in 20 minutes. Okay, so pediatric cancer. The first thing here is to understand that compared to the adult cancer, and probably you're aware about adult cancer, this is a very minor group of patients, only 1% of the patients. And this is for the whole group of cancer patients. Having said that, if you look at it from the pediatric point of view, that's a very common disease. So with the frequency of 1 out of 400 kids between the age of 14, this is one of the major diseases actually that we see in pediatrics. And on the top of it, this is a major killer. People usually don't die of disease. Yeah, there's nasty disease out there, but usually don't die of disease. They will die of trauma. So this is a major killer. This is a major, major disease. So in terms of the childhood acute leukemia, and I will talk a little bit more about the childhood acute lymphoblastic leukemia, but for tonight it's going to be acute leukemia, it will be easier. That's about 1/3 of the cases. So child cancer is rare, but at least 1/3 of the group is acute leukemia. So this is why we can do a lot of different stuff about that group of patients. So on that slide is two key messages for tonight. The first one, Natalie has already discussed about the fact that we're pretty good at treating some type of cancer. So we can cure up to 80% of these cases. And there's some group of childhood leukemia, we can even cure up to 95% of these patients. Having said that, these 20% of patients that are still not responding to treatment or who will die of the disease is still one of the major causes of death for that population. The second point, and again, Natalie already mentioned a little bit about that. And the survivors, so the 80% of the patients surviving their disease, we know now because we have actually data from the first adult cohort of childhood cancer survivors because they are 40 or 45 right now. We know that about 3/4 of these young adults, will suffer from a side effect decades after treatment, usually 20 years after the end of treatment, due to the treatment they received 20 years before. Okay, so there's two major issues there. Still a major killer, sorry for the term, and most of the survivors will suffer some side effects. And we still don't know much about the determinant, whether it's a genomics or biological determinants, about the susceptibility to the disease, to the therapeutic response, and what are the determinants of the short-term or long-term side effects. We still don't know anything. So the stories you will hear about tonight is about two of these issues. So the main goal, not just of my lab, of our own institution, where as in GCN, is to cure these children that are not responding to treatment, so that 20%, okay, and to make sure that the responder, so those that are cured, the survivors, will have an improvement in terms of quality of life, which is a major issue right now. So to face these two issues, we put together a research program, and again, I mean, I'm responsible for that, but I'm not the only one working on that. So we put together a research program along what we call the continuum of healthcare. And for us, that could be translated into resource opportunities. So like diagnostic, that's the time you want to understand what's going wrong in the cancer. You want to understand the etiology. So there's a lot of things that could be done. There's a lot of things we're doing. And then once you have a better diagnostic, you will propose, if it's available, a given treatment. And again, during that phase of the continuum, some will respond, some will not respond, and some will develop toxicity because of the treatment they receive. Again, a lot of opportunities. So tonight I'm going to talk a bit more about one of our initiatives about the targeted therapy in the childhood cancer. And the last part was the survivors. Those that are cured, I just said, there's a major issues there. And we're just starting to do research on that population. And I will talk about one of the our research projects on the early detection biomarkers. So these are the two stories I'm going to talk a bit more today. So on that slide here, I don't want to turn my back to you, so we'll try to describe it. So that's an illustration of what Nathalie describes. So if you look at, let's say, go at the 1950s. So there's a red line there. This is the cure rate for the acute lymphoblastic leukemia. If you look at it, I mean, no one was surviving the disease in the 50s. And suddenly, a set of drugs became available, as Nathalie just mentioned. And by combining these drugs, we started very soon in treatment of childhood cancer to combine drugs. And there's different reasons for that. You're going to ask question later. And we started to increase the cure rate up to mid-90s. So this, when you see the arrow at the bottom here, I mean, up to mid-90s. And in mid-90s, for most of the cancer you see here, particularly in childhood leukemia, we reach a plateau. For the last 20 years, while most make no gain in terms of cure rate. And that's a simple reason. We don't have access to new drugs. There's no interest for pharmas. I mean, those are small, I mean, a small number of people. And so almost no interest. So we needed to find an alternative. And 2-3 years ago, we started to ask that question. Okay, what can we do? There's no new drugs. There's some hope from the immunotherapy side, but in terms of drugs, there's no new drugs. So about 3 years ago, we started to talk about what we could do. And when I say we, it's a mixture of physician and clinician and different people from St. Justin and myself. I mean, I'm a PhD. And what can we do? And at that time, we started to have access to different technologies, what the particular expertise, and we said we could probably put together what we call a targeted personalized therapy program. And the idea here, instead of making a diagnostic, this is a particular leukemia in a subgroup, and this is a therapy that should be given because of the diagnostic, we change a little bit the way to look at it. Could we look at what's going wrong in the cell? And then so molecular alterations, and then try to target that. What are these alterations teaching us? And then from there, try to pick up what would be the drug that is out there. So this is what we call a patient-oriented decision, a molecular patient-oriented decision. The other thing which is interesting in that model, if you're capable of doing that and you're ready to make a decision based on what you're going to find, so it means that the time from research, it will start as a research project because we don't know what we're going to find. If we find something and there's a drug out there, then it's clinic. So it's research on the one side and suddenly become, I mean, a clinic application. So the time between research and translation to clinic is very short. And so that's a new paradigm. And the last point, which is very important, in most cases, and probably in what Natalie is doing, patient will consent to research projects. I mean, in pediatrics, 80% of them will say yes. Okay, but most of them, usually, they won't necessarily benefit from the research. This is for the next generation of patients. In that kind of research program, they might benefit directly of the research, because actually we're doing this for them. Okay, so I'll come back on this. So we put together that program, I would say a little more than 2 years ago, called TRICEP study. So it's an acronym, think about personalized therapy, cancer, pediatric, and then you figure out TRICEP somewhere. So there's three goals for that particular study. The first one is to be able to perform what we call an in-depth genomic base. I'm coming back on genomic and if you say, an investigation to identify what we call patient-specific alteration. Okay, those are the molecular changes in the group of patient of interest. Those are our relapsing or the refractory one. Those are not responding at all to treatment. So those are the 20% of the patients who will die of the disease. That was the idea. The second goal we wanted to achieve there is to assess the number of cancer patients that are actually carrying these mutations. We didn't know. When we started 2 years ago, that was nothing in the literature. We didn't know whether or not it was possible to find this mutation and particular drugs out there, whatever's out there, that will be in the right match. We didn't know. They didn't have any idea. Was it 10%, 50%, all of them? They didn't have any idea. And the third goal that was probably the most challenging one is we need to do this, what I mean by this, from the biopsy, from the time you have identified that patient that's not responding to the time we get the sample, because we need sample, we need something, to do the analysis, get the answer, put together a report that could be readable and understandable by the physician, in everything in a real-time fashion. From the time that we have identified that kid that is not responding, we have 3 months. After that, he's dead. This is what we call real-time fashion. Okay? Totally complete paradigm shift in terms of research. So that was possible because of the new tools, the new toys or tools, depending on who's playing with that, and then in genomic. So we have the capacity now to sequence whole genome. I mean, right now. Not tomorrow, but right now. It's getting cheaper and cheaper. The machines are out there. We're very fortunate in Montreal to have a lot of these machines. And what is the meaning of sequencing the whole genome? Okay, the whole genome actually is the genome is your book of life. Everything is there. Okay, and your book of life is constituted of more than 3 billion letters. Okay, so if you want to have a certain image of what is it, imagine book of 1,000 pages. You would need 127 books to cover your book of the life. Okay? So if you want to sequence the whole genome, you want to sequence every one of these 3 billion letters. So you need particular machines. Then, of course, you need computer guys. Okay? Because you won't look at these letters one by one. So that's a lot of work. What we can do is to narrow down the analysis. You might not need to look at the entire book of life. Okay, so what we've decided to do is to look at the part of it called the exome. Forget about the name. This is where actually where the, most of the meaningful information is hiding. Okay, but that represents only 2.5 books. So at least you narrow down the where you're looking for the information. It's easier, it's less costly, and so on. So this is a decision we made in the past. We're going to look at that 2.5 books. So these at the exome. We have put together over the years, through different sources of funding, what we call, and we're still calling it, the Childhood ALL Integrated Genomic Program. So everything is there. The pipelines are there. We know, I mean, the biobanking activities are there. We can receive the specimen, do whatever it has to be done. Sequencing machines are available. The bioinformatic guys are there. Everything is there. So we actually capitalize on that. And then the next step was that. So what we're looking for, actually, we're screening the exome for typing errors. Mutation is a typo. This is what we're looking for. Okay. So we're looking for typing errors across the whole genome or the exome. Okay. The next step, so this is what the bioinformatician guys will do, and with the eye of the biologist and the clinician, is to put these typing errors in different flavors. Because why not enter research in all the flavors, like candies? Somebody prefer a different type of the other one. So if you look at that sentence there, so the regular sentence would be get the red hat. Okay, this is the regular direction. So if you have a mutation, then you can change the meaning of it. Okay, like the second row, you see get the red cap. So again, here it depends. If the meaning of the sentence is just to cover your hair, your head, you're okay. I mean, this is not meaningful for us. Okay? So if you go on and then you have another mutation, it changes app for cat, then you change the meaning. Okay? Those are the mutations we're looking for in the genome. Those are meaningful information. It doesn't mean that they're going to be actionable later, but they're meaningful. They're changing the sense of what we're looking for. And this is what we're looking at. And I could go on and on, but just give you an idea. The real-time problem is this one, as I said. Once we've identified the patient, we need to get the biological samples. Okay, somehow. And then do the sequencing. So looking, we need to look for these typo errors. Identify what they call the flavors. So this is what we call annotation. From there, put together a report that could be read and then understood by the physician. Talk with the referring physician. And then talk with what we call the tumor board and molecular board to discuss in the group, because we need a lot of heads and brains to figure out what's going on there, and then make a decision. So this is the results from yesterday. So we started 2 years ago, actually in April 2 years ago. So we have enrolled so far 29 patients. Only one refused. That was actually a shock, but in a good way. We didn't know what to expect. We didn't know whether or not the parents would say yes, because those are actually parents, and they became aware that there was no treatment for the patient, that the patient will die of the disease. We didn't know whether or not they would say they had enough. We need the closure, and that's the end of it. But most of them, except for one, said yes. That was the first surprise. And you can see here that was not just open for leukemia patient, but one-third of them were for leukemia patient. That's the basic slide, but just stay focused on the circles. So you have the leukemia patients, and on your right, what you see are the typo errors. This is called the targeted drivers. Over there. So those are the typo errors. Don't have to look at the names there. So we find out a lot of these guys. And then the second step is to say, okay, those are the typo errors. We like the flavors. Those are pretty nice flavors. A pretty tasty mutation. And then we need to figure out whether we can do something with that. And that's the kind of thing you can do with that information. We can use that information, which we call for the detection of residual disease. So that means that you want to follow the disappearance of the cancer cells, so the reappearance when they relapse. So you can use that tools to figure out whether or not they will respond to the ongoing treatment. You can use that information to figure out, hey, I mean, the mutation that we have here, that's a strong indication that they won't respond to any chemo at all. So that could be bone marrow transplantation right away. And that could be a targetable mutation. There's a drug out there. This is what we call clinical trials here. There's a drug out there that's not been designed for childhood leukemia. Maybe adult cancer. We don't know. But that seems to be the best drug for that particular alteration of the pathway that is altered. And this is what we call targeted therapy. Okay. And what we found actually for all of these patients that underwent the in-depth genomic investigation, we found an actionable mutation for all of them. I said at the beginning, we didn't know to which extent would be useful for all of them to find something. And that's just to give you an idea of the report with lots of colors, so the clinicians like that kind of report, but it's easy to read. So here, I mean, for that story, so what I would like to highlight is the fact that it is possible to find this mutation in a real-time fashion. I didn't say it, I just forgot. But, I mean, it's possible to do this between 8 and 9 weeks. So it's less than 10 weeks, so it's possible to do this. I mean, you need to do a lot of work, but it's possible to do this. It's possible to identify these clinically relevant genomic alteration and do something with it. And what was also interesting, because we're capable of doing something for these patients that didn't have any therapeutic alternative before, it is changing as well the practice. So on the clinician, the surgeon was not so please to get a biopsy for nothing. But here, we need biological material. So they're ready to go in surgery surgery room, get the biopsy we need to be able to perform the experiment. So it's changing the practice as well. So the second story is about survivorship. And then, so on the slide here, what you see are two identical twins that suffer from leukemia. So it's pretty obvious which one suffered from leukemia, which one didn't get any problem. Just for information, this is the one on your right that suffered leukemia. So here, what we wanted to do, we initiated that program 5 or 6 years ago. And the idea there is we knew it from the literature that about 3/4 of the survivors will suffer side effects. So we knew it. And the question is it possible to identify what we call early detection biomarkers? So it means that biomarkers that will use to identify those patients, those actually the cure for the disease, okay, that are higher risk of developing a particular side effects before actually diagnosed for that. Otherwise, it's too late. Okay, so that was the idea when we built the project. So what you see here is the four major side effects that we see for the kids, the acute lymphoblastic leukemia patients that are treated, almost everywhere in the Western countries. And the side effects will be different from cancer to cancer. It depends on the drug receiving. So bone morbidities. Here we're talking about osteonecrosis and osteoporosis, and here we're talking about young kids and young girls, 25, 40. Okay. There's one of the kids here that has a problem with osteonecrosis. He has a hip replacement at 12, 14. Okay. And cardiac toxicity, physical activity, metabolic syndrome, and then so that would be associated with increased risk of cardiac diseases and type 2 diabetes, neurocognitive deficits, so attention, learning deficit, mood issues, suicidal thoughts and so on. So those are not actually minor side effects. So we put together a study called PETAL. You certainly know that we love acronyms. And so what I want to show here, that was a multidisciplinary team grant that we got from the CHR and a lot of other partners back then. So each piece actually is a part. So we put, that was a team, but it was like sub-projects or sub-team that were the focus on the particular side effects. So there was a group of people, for instance, on bone morbidities, endocrinologists and other experts were involved. For the cardiac toxicity, there was cardiologists and other experts as well. So there was a group of experts, and the glue was the genomic. But I won't go back to genomic anymore. You're expert now. So the next challenge was, after we put the team together, was to make sure that they're talking to each other. And the major discussion, what are the tests that has to be done on a clinical basis? What are the biological tests that you need, the data from questionnaires that you need to be able for each of these side effects to identify the subgroup which are the hyper-abnormals and the hyper-normal. What I mean by that, if you look at the cardiotoxicity, within the cohort that we were studying, which are individuals that are hyper-normal with all the parameters that we have to assess the cardiotoxicity. And compared to that, who are the hyper-normal? And then compare these two groups. This is what we call the phenotypes. So the problem here was not to get insight from these guys, but there was too many, actually, insights. So at one point, we had to fit it in a particular, and whatever word in English, we'll have to figure out to help me. I call it parcours du combattant. And then, so we couldn't ask these people, these participants, the young adults who are either at school or working, to come back to St. Justine every month to have a test done. So we figured out a way, it took 1 year, figured out a way, the perfect day. So it started at 7 in the morning, ended up at 4 in the afternoon. And if you don't know if you had the chance to take a look at it, if you want to do it by yourself in the public sector, you probably need 3 or 4 years to get all these tests and all the specialists. So we did it. And that was probably why the program was successful, because it was a strong buy-in by the participants. And so we will be done. The study is not done yet. We will be done in a month from now. So patient 250 will be recruited in a month from now. But these are some highlights. So for the bone morbidities, and those were undiagnosed conditions. Okay. So for bone morbidities, we found 20% of the survivors fractures, vertebral fractures, undiagnosed. And then vitamin D deficiencies. I'm saying undiagnosed, and we were very surprised even at the beginning after patient 10 or 20. And half of those are high-risk patients. We know that 3/4 of them will develop a side effect later on. half of these patients, the survivors were not patients. Half of these survivors didn't have any family physician. They don't have any access to family physician. Okay, so that was one of the big surprise. So we had actually in the meantime to figure out a network of referring clinicians on the adult side, because at St. Justine we're taking care of children. So cardiac toxicity, about one third of them are pretty bad physical conditions, and there's a lot of problems with that. We found some genetic association, that was one of the ideas as well, with our toxicity. Metabolic syndrome, again, we find some association between genetic variants and obesity and insulin resistance. And half of them, to some extent, were affected with dyslipidemia. So that was a shock. From the neurocognitive effect, quality of life, there was a long list. Okay, there's only two here. So about half of them, at least one cognitive deficit, and 20% were either anxious and depressive. And what was interesting for that, especially for the quality of life aspect, we also asked the parents to fill the questionnaires. And remember, they were treated at least 20, 25 years before. And even then, they were still suffering from distress and anxiety of the parents. So it's so this is my last one. So where are we going with that? And then there's still a lot of work to be done. As I said, we build that research program along with that continuum in healthcare. So we're doing a lot of work. Didn't have the time to present it today about patient certification. So to be able to put the right patient in the right square to receive the right treatment, we've been good to do it. This is why we achieved that 80% success rate. The problem with that, we're seeing so much side effects, so there are probably a lot of these patients are over-treated. So they're not necessarily in the right square. So they are treated, they are cured, but they're probably over-treated. So there's still a lot of work to be done on these under-treated patients. And that's not that easy to address, because you don't want to tell individuals, well, I think that treatment that we know can cure a patient up to 80%, that we might offer you a different treatment because we think that the toxicity, and you see what I mean? So it's not that easy. There's a lot of work going down on the short side effects. So this is more on the pharmacogenetics, I would say, part, to better identify the responder and responder even before giving the treatment, try to explain the toxicity and, again, deal with that. The long-term side effects, the survivorship issues, as I said, one of the problems is the continuum between pediatrics and adults. Very often when we lose these patients from the clinic, the pediatric sector, we're losing them in the adult world, and it's not that easy to see what's going on with these individuals. And for the alternative therapies, we talk about targeted therapy, but we also, you heard about immunotherapy. Immunotherapy as well is a strong way of treating these patients. It's usually not the first line of treatment. So I'm going to stop here by acknowledging the people that are actually doing the work in the labs, because I don't have the time to be in the lab. And thank you.
So our last talk tonight, and for this whole year, is the part that is always very inspiring and stimulating. And tonight, as you can see, we have a young patient. Jessica is 22 years old. She's a student at McGill University in environmental science. And she was diagnosed a few years ago with Hodgkin's lymphoma, and she's been treated. And she's been in remission for almost a year. And so she's a patient of Dr. Johnson. And we will hear her quest to life.
My name is Jessica. I'm 22 years old. I've been in remission for over a year, and today I'm just going to talk about what happened to me, like how I felt about it, how I dealt with it, and how it still impacts me today. It's just important to know that this is just like my experience. A lot of like everybody's different for how they deal with it and they handle it. So for me, it started with a 4 month long cough that I had from about January until April 2014. By the time May or June hit, I started to notice two ping pong ball sized lumps just above my collarbone. I still felt okay, and I just kind of assumed that maybe they'd always been there, and I just didn't really notice. My mom finally convinced me to go to the doctor to get them checked out. So I went to just a local, clinic. The doctor there told me that it was probably nothing to worry about and that it was just the swelling from the infection that I had had for the cough. But after a few more weeks, they did not recede. They seemed to be still growing. So at my mom's insistence again, I went to see my private doctor, I guess you could say. And from there, it was pretty quick. They sent me to the Jewish General Hospital. At this point, I still really didn't have any idea what was going on. my doctor had called my house after I had seen him, and you know, he was like, "Oh, well, you know, this is just going to be a quick thing. They're going to take care of you for 6 months, and then after that, everything's going to go back to normal." And I was just like, "Oh, okay." Like, but I don't know if they're allowed to tell you at that point what they think it is. But anyway, so I went to see Dr. Johnson, the Jewish general. My mom came with me. She already started crying when we got to the oncology section. I, again, just assumed that was where all blood tests were taken, and I wasn't really considering what was going on. After I saw Dr. Johnson, she explained that this was probably what it was, and then I got a biopsy done. And I was confirmed diagnosed with Hodgkin's in August of 2014. So at this point in my life, I had just moved away from my parents' home. I had just started a new job downtown part-time, and I was going into my second year of university. This was, you know, it's a busy time for me. So at first, I was told there was a possibility that I wouldn't even lose my hair. And from doing a little background research just online, I read that, you know, like about 90% of patients in my age group tend to, you know, get better and not get it ever again. So for me, I thought it wasn't really going to be that bad. I could just kind of do it on the side and still keep doing everything else that was important to me at that time. Once we sat down with the doctor, and what the treatment regimen would be, I was told that I would have to give up school at least. So this was the first thing that really bothered me because I knew that at this point I would be set back a year behind my friends and my peers who were also in university at the same time as I was. And I know as well that my family did want me to move back home with them because they wanted to take care of me. And it was very nice to know that I was, you know, so loved and people wanted to take care of me. but I still did want my freedom and my independence that I felt that I had worked for. So I insisted on still living with my roommate downtown and still working part-time. So I started on the ABVD chemo that Dr. Johnson explained to you. It's commonly used for Hodgkin's lymphoma in North America. The first day I went to chemo, I was told by the nurses that I would probably not be able to keep my hair. They hadn't seen that very often. And I also had the uncommon side effect of being being sensitive to sunlight. So every time after that, I had to be placed in a room, kind of secluded away from any windows and stuff like that. My first kind of impression about the chemo was that it was unpleasant. I didn't really like having the needle in my arm for 2 hours, and even though, you know, they kind of said that you'd get used to it and you wouldn't feel it after 2 hours, I still kind of felt it. Also, the chemo, as it's going through your veins, it burns a little. But I took it as it was only like a couple of hours every 2 weeks, so with the end result of getting better, I didn't see that as such a big deal. Losing my hair, though, was like hands down the worst and the most difficult part of the whole thing for me, because up until that point, I had still managed to keep what was going on like a secret from, you know, like my work and like anyone except my close family and friends. I had to start wearing headscarves and wigs, and even just taking the metro, I felt that people were looking at me differently. And I know now that this was probably all just in my head, but at the time, like in the moment, it felt different. My mom had told me at the beginning that I should probably have let everyone know right away, like, what was going on and that I was sick. But I did wait until it was obvious, and that was my decision, I guess. So about 3/4 of the way through the treatment, I developed an allergy to the ABVD chemo. This would cause my blood pressure to drop dramatically, and because of this, I would shiver uncontrollably, and my extremities would turn blue, no matter how many blankets they would put on top of me. This was, I think, when I felt like the sickest, because I remember being told that I had to go get x-rays because of this, and they had to bring me down in a wheelchair, even though I felt that I could walk, but they said it had to be in a wheelchair, so I went in the wheelchair. And my mom was pushing me in the wheelchair, trying really hard not to cry, and I was wearing a hospital gown, and I hadn't had a headscarf on, so I was bald. And people passing by would avert their eyes from me because they felt that I was, like, I was hard to look at. And this, like, really almost made me cry, too, because I felt that they pitied me and my mom when, in my mind, I knew this was only a temporary thing and that I was going to get better. But obviously, from outside perspective, it didn't look that way. So after the allergic reaction happened 2 times in a row, it was decided that I would be put on an almost equally effective, different, but in some ways harsher chemo called Biocop, which is not really used often in North America. It's used more in Europe. So this was the last couple of cycles. I was told that this one would be more intense, and because of this, I would have to stop working as well. This was also very difficult for me because I felt like freedom after freedom was being taken from what I was able to do. But in retrospect, it was only 4 months, and even though it wasn't a great fun month, it was really just 1 month. So after going through everything, after the set amount of chemo that I was decided would be enough for me, I actually did go into remission. This was in March 2015. So after that, my family threw a party in my house. 75 people showed up to congratulate me, so it was kind of nice. My hair started growing back about a month later, and that was also very exciting. I do honestly feel like experiencing this did give me a new appreciation for life, in the sense that I know that like anything can happen to you, and you really only have this one life to live. So you have to really make the most of it. One thing that I did learn from this is that there is always a reason to feel lucky with what you have. No matter what your situation is, someone else is always, you know, worse than what you're going through. For me, this was because I knew that my cancer was temporary. And there's a lot of people that I saw, and I met a couple whose cancers weren't temporary, and they were trying chemo after chemo after chemo, and it wasn't getting any better. So it was almost humbling in that sense, and it makes you want to help them out in any way you can. I also want to mention briefly how great the Jewish General Hospital was, with how much support they provide to their cancer patients. They do have an awesome organization called Hope and Cope, which organizes all kinds of activities that you can join if you feel up to it or you want to. And they also offer counseling if, again, if you need it or if you feel like you want to talk to someone about it. I know that I was actually treated in one of the best hospitals for cancer. So in closing, my life has gone pretty much back to normal now, a year later. I'm back in school full-time and working part-time at the same job. And I'm almost even more excited to finish my degree because I do see my peers who are now graduating this year. I feel like I'm more experienced and maybe more mature than I was before going through this. Also, anyone who knows that I've gone through chemo as well and are in the similar situation where either they're going through chemo or they know someone who's going through chemo, they tend to talk to me now just because I'm able to relate in a certain sense. And I really like being able to kind of give back in that way where I can just listen to others and, you know, help them out that way. Just in closing, for anyone who is going through or will go through lymphoma, there are plenty of people who are willing to help you, and you're not alone. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Jessica. So if you have questions, please write them out on the cue cards, and the volunteers will be bringing down some of the questions. And I would ask the panel to, if you want to come to the front, Jessica, you Okay, so the first question is for Dr. Jones. If knocking out HIF-1 halts cell proliferation and glucose-dependent cancer cell, is there any evidence yet that epigenetics or nutrigenomics could assist as a non-pharmacological form of treatment?
That is an excellent question. Hats off to the person who asked that. It's a really solid question. So I think probably what's at the heart of that question really is down to the point of, are there elements that you can have in your diet which can affect the epigenetics, or the, I guess, what's the best way to describe epigenetics? The decoration of your DNA, which can affect the expression of different genes. And certainly there's a lot of evidence out there that this is actually the case, because a lot of the marks that get changed on your DNA to modify the epigenome are things like acetyl groups or methyl groups, which are actually metabolic products. And so there's a lot of evidence now that there are certain cancers that actually have mutations in different genes that actually affect the production of these metabolic products and change the epigenome of different cancers. So I certainly think that there is the possibility that with more research in this, we can actually find the impact of your diet on the epigenome. And there's a very famous case of, if I can just expand a little bit, of the Dutch hunger from World War II, where cases of extreme famine in families in the Netherlands during World War II, the children that were born into those families actually had heritable changes in things like metabolic syndrome and other traits. And this has now been traced back to changes in their epigenome because of the famine diet of the parents. And so I certainly think that nutritional input can be a part of this. It's a great, good, really good question.
So we have a question for Danielle Sinet. How many of the targeted therapy 29 patients survived?
Well, that's a good question, because when we put the project together, there was a lot of discussion with the clinicians, and I would say that was a generation gap between clinicians, so the old ones and the younger ones. And the way to get the project approved, that was a feasibility project. We needed to show that we actually can do it. So the first patient that will undergo a clinical trial with a new drug will start in a week from now. And then, so there's no one patient so far that been treated with the new drug. So the first one will start in 2 weeks. Yeah. But from there are colleagues in Toronto who have started a similar project a year after us, using a similar approach, and for half of the patients, I think they enrolled about 20 patients. So I think 19 of them were offered the alternative treatment. For half of them, there was no change, no progression, no regression of the tumor, no change at all. And for another four, there was an improvement, so a decrease of the tumor site. And for another 25%, they didn't respond. So I would expect the same probably rate over here.
Natalie, some questions for you. What is the difference between Hodgkin's lymphoma and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma?
So we separate these lymphomas.
So that's a good question, too. So morphologically, they're very different. Hodgkin's lymphoma, the actual tumor cells are genetically different, they look different, they're bigger, and they only represent 1% of the entire lymph node. The rest is inflammatory cells, whereas non-Hodgkin's is anything but Hodgkin's, but the most common is diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. When you look at the morphology of the tumor, most of what you see are tumor cells.
Which one is easiest to cure?
Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Why?
That is an excellent question. We're studying the biology of Hodgkin's, but because of this challenge that it only represents 1% of the entire tumor, it is challenging to understand that biology. You have to pick them one by one, or you have to sort them.
What is CLL?
It's a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that's called chronic lymphocytic lymphoma or leukemia. It is biologically different than the two types of lymphoma that I discuss. It's a more often than not slow-growing lymphoma. Typically presents in older patients and where the leukemia lymphoma cells are in the blood, but also very treatable with chemotherapy, a different type of chemotherapy.
So it can be cured?
CLL? CLL, we're talking about remissions, whereby we give chemotherapy and we hope to have a complete or partial remission where the cancer just stays dormant for many years, but quite often comes back, yeah.
What does it prognosticate?
There are prognostic factors in CLL that are different than the prognostic factor in other lymphomas, in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. We don't use the same ones. The stage is an important one.
Does CLL reduce the fasting glucose level?
When we measure glucose in all our patients every time, and we don't see any difference in glucose levels.
For Danielle Sinet, could you comment on this? Using a drug targeted against a particular oncogene is not effective if used in different malignancies. Example, BRAF drug, an anti-BRAF drug in CRC versus melanoma.
Yeah, this is true. So what we have to be careful and when you're treating cancer patients, I mean, there's several things, but two things. And then there's the, we never know what are the new mutations out there. So they could have an interaction between mutations, so different genes would be mutated. But the most important part is the environment. The environment of a tumor is totally different from tumor for tumor, so that could affect the treatment as well.
Maybe this one for Rusty. Is there scientific proof that sugar is that dietary sugar is a driver in oncological disease?
So that's a good question. I don't think there's any evidence that sugar drives disease. I think maybe touching back on the aspect of glucose, the important thing is that, so I mentioned that tumor cells take up sugar. The difference is about measuring sugar in our blood sugar in patients is that what's amazing that even if tumors have a higher requirement for sugar, your blood sugar typically doesn't change. And the reason is that we have a very strong physiological system that actually maintains your blood sugar even when you don't eat, when you're in a fasted state. And that's the process of gluconeogenesis, where you actually, your body makes glucose to keep your blood sugar level at the same level. And this is important because we use glucose for different tissues like your brain. So this gets to Nicole's question. Right now, there's no real evidence that high sugar can drive tumors. So, for example, if you're diabetic and you're hyperglycemic, does having high blood sugar drive tumorigenesis? There's no evidence for that. However, there is a subset of cancer that is actually responsive to insulin and insulin-like growth factors. Okay, and so these are hormones or signaling molecules that will actually promote the growth of different tumors that have that rely on IGF receptors for signaling. And, of course, you increase the expression of insulin in response to high blood sugar. So there is some evidence that if you are an insulin or IGF-responsive tumor, high blood sugar is not good because you're essentially increasing your insulin levels in the body. So it's not necessarily to do with sugar, but insulin and insulin growth factor.
I have to say, I just finished correcting my graduate student's final exam, and the questions you have posed tonight, you would all pass with flying colors. Let's see if they pass with flying colors. Do childhood leukemia, ALL, cancer cells behave differently than adult leukemia cells?
That's a great question. And there's no clear answer. In childhood ALL, there was a lot of work being done on the treatment, not on the biology. So we figure out the good thing, you saw the graph. So the good thing is we rapidly achieve a certain cure rate without understanding the disease. We treated actually the symptom, it worked, and that's fine. And then, so in terms of treatment, we know a lot of things. And of course, we know a lot of something about the leukemia cells as well. For the adult, ALL in adult, it's pretty rare compared to, I mean, it's more frequent than the childhood ALL, but compared to the other type of adult cancer, it's pretty rare. So we know very few things about adult ALL. What we do know from the treatment perspective, until very recently, I'm talking about a year or two ago, and there were, I don't know why, I don't have any reason, this is the adult world, scientific world, they were treated totally different way in the pediatric world. And the success rate was pretty low. And they started 2 years ago to apply actually the same protocol as in pediatrics. And the success rate pretty raised. So I would imagine for certain type of the adult ALL, the biology is probably similar because it's responding similarly. But we don't know a lot of things. But based on the treatment, it seems to behave slightly similarly.
How early on do we see cognitive effects on survivors?
Over here, over there.
I think that there are temporary effects very early on. They call it chemo brain or chemo fog, being forgetful, but that usually resolves. It does resolve. So I don't see a lot of the cognitive, long-term cognitive defects in the adolescent young adult patients treated with ABVD. It's not a recognized side effect. It's more the psychosocial mood
disorders
that are a problem.
What we see for children with ALL, so it's for those high-risk patients that will receive radiation, cranial irradiation, for those who will see acute cognitive impacts. So as soon as the treatment is over, they will usually recover. Slowly but surely, but they will recover. For the long-term effect, it doesn't seem to be related to the radiation. It seems to be related to the chemo, so we're surprised by that. But we're not the only one to see this, but that will be later on.
I just have a comment about your last answer with the pediatric and older adult ALL. Yeah. So it is true that the older adults don't fare as well. I think there is some biology changes. There's more rearrangements in the fiddle dot for chromosome translocations that we'd see in older, never see in kids, which we treat differently with Gleevec, imatinib. And the pediatric protocols that he's referring to that we use in the adolescent and young adults less than 40 are brutal. They would never be the older, being over than 40, would not be able to tolerate those protocols. The kids go through.
If a leukemia survivor relapses into adulthood, does the survivorship percentage change? Does the chance of surviving change?
You relapse later?
Yeah.
You mean much later?
Yeah, in adulthood. Presumably if they had leukemia as a child,
okay,
and move on to adulthood.
For the childhood ALL, the survivor, we don't see that much often. We will see a relapse during treatment, a relapse a couple of years after the end of the treatment. I mean, in terms of adult, it's pretty rare. So it's, yeah.
What are the long-term effects of chemotherapies used for Hodgkin's?
The most common long-term toxicities, which we see in actually very few patients that don't get radiation. If you don't get radiation, it's just ABVD. The risk of bone marrow, long-term bone marrow toxicity, about 1 to 2%. Risk of developing non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is about 1 to 2%. Cardiac abnormalities are not very common with the doses of anthracycline that we use. And again, without radiation, I think it's when you combine chemo and radiation that you get these long-term cardiac endocrine toxicities and secondary cancers.
Is there any way that we can control the leukemia in children with some special diets?
That's not an easy one. Because I mean, everything could be related to the diet, good or bad. So it's we don't have any evidence that it's a trigger of the disease. What we know, though, from the survivorship study, and because of that, we are initiating a new study. And diet is very key issue for, I wouldn't say the success of the therapy, but it's part of it. But to decrease the long term effect, that's very important. For as a trigger for the disease, I don't see any evidence in the literature or through our work. But in terms of the survivorship, we see a huge issue. They rapidly gain bad habits in terms of nutrition for a lot of reasons. If you give me a couple of seconds, the treatment for the, it's probably the same thing for, depends on the drug again, but for childhood ALL, the treatment of receiving will have a huge impact on the tasting. So everything will taste like metal. And then, so to be able to taste something, then they will try something more salty, more greasy, so McDonald's. And they will keep that habit over years and over years. So what we're seeing with survivors, so the fact that they have overweight and obese is largely due to that. So the habits that they acquired after the or during the treatment, not before.
What is the impact on male sexuality of chemotherapy and radiation?
Mine are too young. So it's yours.
Yeah. My kids have sex. Yeah. It is Quebec.